Although January 1st, 1808 probably doesn't strike most of us as a particularly significant date, Ned and Constance Sublette see it as one of the most important in U.S. history. In their book, The American Slave Coast, they explain that it was on that date that the United States banned the importation of African men, women, and children to be sold as slaves. And while it might sound like a date to celebrate, as the Sublettes explain in their fascinating book, it is probably not. Bringing in more African slaves was halted, not for humanitarian reasons, but to protect the lucrative business of slave breeding that was operating at that time in Virginia. The book is published by Lawrence Hill Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought them to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for having us.
And your subtitle is A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. It's a pretty shameful story, and I don't think it's widely known. How much of what you have written about here is even being taught in U.S. classrooms?
What is being taught in U.S. classrooms at the moment? You know, you saw the Texas textbook, the McGraw-Hill Texas textbook that caused so much furor a couple of months ago, that said that millions of workers from Africa were brought to agricultural plantations in the southern United States, and there's been this hue and cry about it. But most of the fury was about the word workers, which as inadequate or inappropriate to describe the condition of slaves. But what very few people in the media pointed out, and this is kind of shocking to me that how few people caught this, is that whether you call them workers or slaves or whatever, the sentence isn't true. Millions of Africans were not brought to the United States. And that in its own way sanitizes U.S. history because it erases the slave breeding industry.
After 1808, the United States slave trade became an entirely domestic affair?
That's correct.
Even without importing additional Africans, didn't the slave population increase by about 25% every 10 years?
That's also correct, and there's a reason for that, because we also expanded our territory, and we needed more labor, and there was a great pressure put upon the women of the slave-owning population to increase their childbearing rate, to bear children as fast as possible, as early as possible, and as often as possible.
And when slaves were brought in from Africa, weren't families kept intact at least for a time? Was that true with slave breeding?
No, that was not true at all. The whole point of slave trading was to separate the adolescents and the healthiest out so that the people in the coffles who these enormous chain gangs that were a common sight in the South, people walking in chains from the Chesapeake or Kentucky down to the Deep South for 5 weeks at a time, complete nuclear families were almost entirely absent from these coffles.
And we tend to look upon these stories in very human terms, but the story you're telling here is a story of politics and economics.
It's a story of the logic of capital and how it was brought to bear on American slavery, which I think the reason we wrote our book is to try to write a new history of the U.S. that placed slavery and the business of slavery at the center.
And you've said that you approach writing this book with the premise that the history of American slavery was the history of the American slave breeding industry. Didn't that initial understanding reframe the way that you even understood every subsequent event in U.S. history after 1808?
It does. Centering slavery and the slave breeding industry and the economic and territorial expansion of the United States means that you cannot separate anything that happened in United States history starting in the colonial era from this issue.
In 1861, when the South went to war with the North, one of the goals of the slave owners was not to simply be allowed to continue the practice of slavery but within the borders of the United States, but also to expand the market for slaves further into the West and maybe even to Cuba and Canada?
That's right. Slavery, the slave breeding industry was a Ponzi scheme. As one territory filled up with cleared farms, the hardest work was clearing the land. Once the labor forces were established, once the plantations were set in, territories that had formerly imported enslaved laborers from Virginia or Maryland, there was a conversion cycle, and they became exporters of laborers to the new territories. It was a Ponzi scheme that drove American expansion.
And you've also reframed the way most of us think of slaves as labor in the southern United States. But slaves not only provided labor, they also served as merchandise and as capital. Did the cash value of the slaves owned by a southern plantation owner rival or even eclipse the amount of money that their land and their crops were worth?
That's also true. And how that worked is, of course, they provided, their labor provided the crops that were the cash flow for the plantation, or if they are rented out for a family to pay their own mortgage on their house in Richmond, and so on. But along with that, they themselves functioned as money. And I would like...
In other words, before there was national currency, slaves functioned as currency?
Yes, and I would like to have Ned talk about this because he talks about it very well.
Okay, Ned. I mean, your turn.
Slaves were a means of exchange. The South didn't have much in the way of gold and silver. Paper money was unreliable, issued by any number of 1,600 different banks that might go out. If a farmer made money with a crop, there was very little way to keep the money except in the form of storing it in human bodies. Slaves were human savings accounts, and nobody explained it better than Thomas Jefferson, who wrote in a letter when he was 77, "I know of no error more consuming to an estate than stocking farms, he wrote, "with men almost exclusively. I consider that a woman who brings a child every 2 years more productive than the best man of the farm. What she produces is an addition to the capital, whereas his labors disappear in mere consumption."
My guests are Ned and Constance Sublett, Sublette. Their book, The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. So Jefferson was from Virginia, and Virginia was the center of slave breeding, a rival to North Carolina, which South Carolina, which is where the slaves were imported?
Yeah. A lot of American history talks about the clash between the North and the South, but the main dramatic conflict in our book is between the Upper South, Virginia, the great slave breeder, versus the Lower South, Carolina, the great slave importer, for control of the supplying the labor to the expanding slavery nation.
So this was a decision by the White House and Congress to favor Virginia by passing a law that prevented the import of slaves in 1808? Well, who was the president at the time?
Thomas Jefferson.
A Virginian.
Yeah, a Virginian. And the beginning,
and a slave owner.
The Virginian and the beginning of a Virginia dynasty. Of course, four of the first five presidents were slave owners.
The protection of the slave importing industry, the slaves coming in from Africa, which was something that South Carolina did a great deal and depended upon, was put into the Constitution itself, which didn't say, it gave a date by which it could be stopped, but it didn't say that it had to be stopped. But when that was done at the Constitutional Convention, no one knew that there was going to be a drop by Napoleon in a fit of temper almost into the lap of the United States, what we call the Louisiana Purchase, this extremely large territory. But people were already pushing into it from what became the United States. So when Jefferson was president, he understood this very well. And at the very first date that he was able to do this, he signed into law excluding the importation of persons.
But there was a debate over the years that followed as to what parts of the Louisiana Purchase would allow slaves and which wouldn't. Was that something that was even considered at the time, or was it assumed that the whole territory would wind up being an area with slavery?
Well, Louisiana up through Missouri, which was also part of the Louisiana Purchase, was slave territory. There was just no question about that.
I was taught in my U.S. history courses that the economy of the South collapsed after the Civil War because it no longer had the labor that it needed to run its plantations. But you're suggesting here the real problem was that they didn't have the slaves, which was their real wealth?
That's absolutely correct. 60%, 80% of a planter's wealth might be in his slave holdings. Land was worth relatively little. People's wealth was stored in the form of their slave holdings.
To say that land was worth relatively little was true before the war. And one way of looking at that is to notice that Mississippi in 1860 had the most millionaires per capita in the United States. And after the war, the economy of Mississippi plunged to make it now still number 50 of the United States.
It's the poorest of all the U.S. states.
Slaves were all the wealth Mississippi ever had.
When were the first African slaves imported into what's now the United States?
Well, Africans were mostly imported before there was the United States. I mean, the first sale, of course, in Virginia is notated by John Rolfe, the 20 and odd Negroes in 1690.
Mostly from West Africa?
They were from the Gambia. Senegambia was the preferred point of origin, partly because it was closer and fewer people died. It was harder to get Africans up to North America. So it wasn't really... like I say, relatively few Africans were brought here, 389,000. That's Barbados, which is the size of Queens, took more Africans than the entire present-day United States.
So they were coming through South Carolina, as you say.
And then South Carolina brought in more than anywhere else, yeah.
And then they were being bred here, obviously, for future generations. Do you have any idea of why we have this difference, why Virginia winds up the breeding state and South Carolina the importation slave state?
Virginia was uniquely set up in the entire hemisphere to have a slave breeding industry. In the rest of the hemisphere, most of those 10.7 million or so Africans who arrived alive to the Americas were brought to work on sugar, which was a crop that, when worked according to the logic of capital that dictated that it was cheaper to make people work 20 hours a day in hellish conditions in the peak season and work them to death in 8 or 10 years than to have more laborers and have to feed them during the dead time. They didn't grow sugar in Virginia. Rice in Carolina was also a deadly crop. In colonial Virginia, unprecedented in the hemisphere, the enslaved did not die off, but lived long enough to reproduce enough that their numbers grew by what they called at the time natural increase.
Were they better treated?
The conditions were relatively milder. Not put to work 20 hours a day on sugar. Tobacco was toxic work, but relatively less bad. There was more food, milder climate, did not have tropical diseases, closer to gender parity, all kinds of reasons. But the fact is that Virginia's land played out for tobacco by the time of the Declaration of Independence, so that Virginia planters were already at the time of independence finding that the most profitable thing to do with their laborers was to sell them off to the new territories.
And by breeding slaves, were they reducing the value of the slaves that were being brought in from South Carolina?
It worked the other way around. South Carolina undercut the prices of domestically raised human beings with their imported Africans.
My guests are Ned and Constance Sublette. Their book, The American Slave Coast, it is published by Lawrence Hill Books, and we will continue our conversation after this. On tomorrow's show, New York Times food columnist Melissa Clark will be here to answer your questions about cooking for Thanksgiving. If you've got something you'd like to ask her about turkey, pie crust, or whatever you're making, you can tweet your questions to @LeonardLopate now or send them to us on Facebook. You're listening to WMIC, WMIC.org. And we are back with Ned and Constance Sublette, who have not ever written a book like this before. You've written other books, but this one is a huge book, over 600 pages, called The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. It is published by Lawrence Hill Books. When Jefferson signed that bill that prohibited the importation of African slaves, did he present it as a kind of a humanitarian thing?
Absolutely. He presented it as a humanitarian gesture, but it was protectionism. A humanitarian act would have been to end slavery, but slavery didn't end for 55 more years, and slavery requires a slave trade.
Did the people of South Carolina understand that this was a kind of a slap at them?
They certainly did. For one of the reasons is that he was able to do this because he had the support of abolitionists and anti-slavery people in the North.
Who didn't understand the implications?
No. He was a very good politician.
You've credited a number of presidents, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, James Polk, with spreading slavery through territorial expansion. And all of those men were slaveholders whose wealth was tied up in their slaves.
That's right. Jefferson owned 600 people in the course of his life. Andrew Jackson was a slave trader. I mean, the only president documented as having personally driven a slave coffle. President Polk bought slaves from the White House while in office.
Now, a listener on Twitter points out that although you said that the first five presidents all owned slaves.
I did not say that.
Because Adams.
Did not say
either
that.
Of the Adamses did.
Four of the first five presidents were Virginians.
Who were Virginians?
John Adams was not a slave owner. John Adams detested slavery.
And he certainly wasn't a Virginian.
Yes. Did life get easier or harder for the African slaves already living in the United States when importation from Africa was halted in 1808?
Definitely it got more difficult because suddenly they no longer had the security that the security that they had been able to forge over this period of time of deep-rooted and widely spread family webs and communities. And now suddenly there was a constant threat that this was going to be these communities and families were going to be broken up, which indeed they progressively got broken up more and more as we began settling the lands in the Louisiana Purchase.
The slave breeding that you're describing here isn't like the slave breeding plantations that were imagined in Mandingo, Kyle Onstorts' 1957 novel. Didn't most of the slave breeding take place alongside the business of farming rather than at plantations that were set up for the sole purpose of breeding slaves?
That's right. It wasn't like Mandingo. It was a system. It was a slave breeding system, since every enslaved child at birth was worth $75 or $100. But there was it would have made no sense to have a farm dedicated to raising solely people that would have taken up to 17 years to reach their peak market price. Instead, it was part of farm management, a system of traders, representatives fanned out across the eastern shore of Maryland, across the farms of Virginia after harvest time, and went around buying from farmers who were in trouble, who might need to sell off one or two or more adolescents to pay their debts, and after a while would enter Richmond with 50 or 100 in a chain gang.
On the other hand, didn't you discover evidence that stock or stud male slaves were sometimes used to father large numbers of children with many different slave women?
There are testimonies to that in the slave narratives, both those written by self-emancipated slaves and also in the WPA narratives, just like there is evidence and testimony in these narratives that some women were forced to have children every year.
And pregnant women and women who'd already had children commanded a higher price because their breeding ability had already been proven.
That's
right. There are only a very few mentions, I might add, in the WPA interviews to these kinds of stock men. I think the real historical truth of that has yet to be determined. But there's no question. We hear the term breeder or breeding woman from as early as we have records of large slave owners. William Fitzhugh in the 17th century Virginia, the first big slave owner of whom we have much documentation, was already using the word. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "I consider the labor of a breeding woman as no object."
So is this rape?
Yeah. Slavery was rape.
Yes. Didn't you even read stories about owners castrating male slaves who were small or weak, who they didn't want to see reproduce?
Very little. We don't have any of that in our book. If there was, you know, there might be rumors of that, but we did not find any proof of that.
But the disabled, the young, the weak who were born to enslaved women probably wouldn't live very long. Much the same way that a runt in a litter might not live very long.
Now, the image that we have of slavery from a film like Gone with the Wind, is that at all accurate?
Well, I think it's doubtful that we would find in many families that held slaves that the women who have children of their own loved the children of the people that they were serving more than they loved their own children. It's hard to accept.
And slaves were never depicted as being sold in Gone with the Wind. And this was a fundamental part of slavery, was at some point buying or selling slaves.
Did the process, the breeding process, continue up until the Civil War?
As far as we know, it certainly did. And
but I assume that it spread beyond Virginia over the years.
Yes, and which is another reason, as we had mentioned earlier, there was this panic to expand the territory into which the overstock could be marketed, particularly the drive to annex Cuba as a state.
What about the children of slave owners and their female slaves?
There's a lot of testimony about enslaved. Well, enslaved women could be violated at any time. There's a lot of testimony.
And then
of,
the children
of white
were just
men.
Slaves?
Yeah. Partus sequitur ventrum was the legal term. The status of the newborn follows the status of the womb. A child born to an enslaved woman was enslaved down to the nth generation, because if people are money, children are interest, and no escape from the asset column could be permitted.
Now, Ned, you were here before many years ago to talk about a book you'd written about on
Cuba and its music, from the first drums to the mambo.
And Constance, you have written novels?
Yes, I was writing. It's one of the reasons I was interested in doing a book like this. I'd been writing science fiction and fantasy that dealt with family and reproduction, and I'd gotten very interested in what was happening in the South in the antebellum period. And your interview with Edward Ball back in the day when he published Slaves in the Family in 1998 was a godsend.
You heard that and you thought, well, we have to work on a book.
It's
about,
one of the strands.
Well, I'd imagine that what you're doing here, what you've done here, is a lot of original research. How did you find some of these things?
5 years of looking everywhere we could, reading a lot of newspapers, reading any archival documents we could get to, reading the work of contemporary scholars. There's 1,500 footnotes. Scholars have been doing a fabulous job in the last couple of generations. There's a whole cutting edge of scholarship around these topics. What we did that was different was try to write a general reader arc of American history that takes what we've all learned into some kind of master narrative.
Now, the word eugenics didn't exist at the time, but were there any people who were shocked by what we would now call eugenics during all these years of slavery?
There seems to be a lot of evidence that slave owners were preoccupied with notions of breeding, whether it was, you know, the cotton ball that most perfectly fitted the human hand, the fastest racehorse, or the biggest, strongest slave. It's a very creepy subject.
And one that still is being denied in some parts of our country.
Yes, and it was, we've just been coming off a 7-week tour in support of the book, and we have been finding teachers and parents everywhere we've gone who are really interested in trying to get this material into the schoolroom.
About eugenics, I want to say there is no scientific work about this. There's no real scholarship to base your work on.
Ned and Constance Sublette's book, The American Slave Coast, A History of Slave Breeding, of the Slave Breeding Industry, is published by Lawrence Hill Books, and I thank you both so much for being on our show today.